Let me say again to all of those who are here tonight, welcome. I'm very thankful to see so many faces that I get to see each week, and also to see some new faces who are not always here. Welcome. We're always thankful for the chance to speak to new individuals. And so I want to say again, my name is Christian, and tonight I am going to be talking about the Christmas story again. Let me catch those of you up who have not been here, or if you're just visiting, I want to give you a sense for where we are. Believing that the Christmas story tells the story that is potentially most meaningful, we decided that it would be wise to spend more than just one or two Sundays on it, and instead to look at it week after week through the perspective of different characters within it in hopes of seeing something that would be meaningful and helpful and even transforming for us as people. So 2 weeks back, we looked at the first chapter of Matthew, and we looked at the story from the perspective of Joseph. And there, we heard this announcement that this baby that was coming into the world was not ordinary. This was God with us. Emmanuel was the name the baby was given. And even Jesus, this baby somehow was going to save this world. That was an announcement. The week after that, we moved on to chapter 2, and that was last week. And in chapter 2 of Matthew, I said that we would see two potential responses to this news. On the one hand, which is what we looked at last week, we see what it looks like when someone rejects this news, and that was the figure of Herod. And we looked at the story from his perspective. Tonight, we'll look at it from the opposite perspective, and that is, what does this story look like through the eyes of someone who does not reject it, but rather accepts what is being said in this Jesus? We're going to see the story through the eyes of individuals who are seeking God. Now, before we look at that, I want to ask you to think for a moment. Do you know what it's like to use your eyes to look for something? Everyone knows what that's like. Let me make this more specific. Have you ever sought to find God? Some of you would say, yes, of course I have. Maybe there are some tonight who have never really tried to seek after God. And someone brought you here tonight, and you're wondering, what will this be like? I'm glad you're here. Maybe there are some here tonight who, in this very moment, are actually seeking God, have come on this Sunday to this church to see if there's anything to this stuff. And I would say that in one way or another, all of us, on every time we come to church, are seeking, and we're wanting to see if there is something to this. Do you know what it's like to seek him? Before we look at the story through the eyes of these seekers, the wise men, I want you to open up to Matthew 7. This is the same book that we're going to read from when we get to it, the Christmas story. But I want you to look at these words in Matthew 7. And if you have one of these Bibles there, it's on page 788. It's the seventh chapter of the book of Matthew. And it's verse 7. I want you to look down there while I read these. These are very important words. Listen to these words. Ask, and it will be given you. Search, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened for you. For everyone who asks receives, and everyone who searches finds, and for everyone who knocks, the door will be opened. These words are a promise from Jesus to anyone who would ask truly of him. To all people who would genuinely embark on the search for him. For anyone who would truly knock, seeking to find the path that he has for them. I memorized these words when I was a young man. Let me ask this. Is there anyone in here who knows from experience that this promise is trustworthy? Is there anyone here who knows that? I want you to see something of me in hopes that it will help you see the Magi better, these seekers. When I lived in Princeton, I moved into Princeton in 1996, and I began to study at the seminary there, and I began to study preaching. And I was there for 5 years straight of graduate work. And in the summer after my fifth year, there was something that happened to me, and I bet this happens to most graduate students. It could have been a genuine pang of not knowing if God was leading me, or it could have been the fear of my comprehensive exams. But I started to question whether I was on the path that God intended me to be on. I wasn't sure if this was where he meant for me to be. Now, at this point, I'm a Christian, but even Christians are seekers. And I found myself this summer really doubting whether I was following God or following myself. And it was the summer of 2001. And then something happened in September that all of us remember. On the 11th of that month. And it made me, I was studying preaching, it made me not want to speak anymore when I saw what happened in New York City. It made me want to just sit and listen. And I felt like I hadn't been listening to God. And so I just sat in my apartment. I lived alone. I was scared and alone. I didn't know what was happening in the world. Do some of you remember feeling like that? And I was wondering where God was. And now, more than ever, I was wondering, am I supposed to go be an academic who learns about preaching and then teaches other people about it? I couldn't think of it. And so the morning of the 14th, I got up and I got in my car and I started to drive. And I started heading north. I drove up the seaboard. I actually drove past New York City and I saw the smoke still rising. It tore me in my guts. I just wanted to keep driving. I drove all the way until about 2 hours before sunset, and I made it to Acadia National Forest in Maine. Anyone ever been there? I started driving around, and I thought, I'll park on the side, and maybe I'll hike up to one of the peaks, and I'll look at the ocean. Everywhere I looked, there were signs that said, no parking after dark, and it was starting to get to the dusk. So I pulled off into the weeds, and I thought, this car, it's not that valuable anyway. It was a piece of junk. I didn't care. I pulled over, crossed the street, and I saw the trailhead sign. It said, Pemetic Peak. It's the tallest one in Acadia. I thought, perfect. I'll walk up to the top. I went back to my trunk. I had in my trunk a small hatchet. I found a pack of matches in my car, and I filled my right pocket with beef jerky, and I had in my other hand a Nalgene with water in it. And I started to walk. Started going up. Hiked for about 45 minutes up. There were some voices coming from above down, and it was two women. And they saw me, and they said, oh, hey, what are you doing? And I thought, wow, they're interested in me. This is cool. You know, they were attractive. I was single. And I thought, they asked me for my phone number, actually. I had my cell phone with me. I gave it to them. I was sort of flattered. Then they said, are you planning to come back, go all the way to the top and come back down? Because it's going to be dark soon. They asked for my phone number because they were afraid for me. I hadn't thought of it yet, but it was either turn back now or go to the top and stay overnight there. And so I decided to go up and stay overnight. Here's why. I thought, I'm looking for God. And maybe when I get to the top and I sit by myself and I leave all this busyness of the world behind me, I'll find him. And so I went on and I got up there about 45 minutes before the sun would set. And I used those 45 minutes to cut some boughs of a pine tree to gather up as much dry wood as I could. And I found a crack in the rock between a 6-foot drop-off. And the top of Pemetic Peak has no trees on it because of the wind from the ocean. So it was just rock, bare rock. And I made there a small pile of pine. And I set up my pile of dry wood. And I ranged a ring of rock and I started a fire. And it started to get cold. I had jeans and just my skateboarding sneakers on. I had a hoodie sweatshirt and that suede leather coat that I got at the thrift shop. Some of you see me still wear that sort of goofy like lumberjack coat. I buttoned it up and I start sitting close to the fire. And you know what I started to do? Is I started to pray. And this was mostly just saying, God, I'm looking for you. I'm seeking you. I'm asking you. I want to find you. I'm knocking because I have no idea what you need for me to do with my life. Would you please reveal yourself to me? And then I sat by this fire, which was dangerous now because the wind was getting really strong as it was getting dark. The flames were shooting 15 feet up in the air. They were roaring. I looked up and I had never, ever seen stars like this. And I waited for him to say something to me. I thought, there's going to be some, I don't know, there's going to be some sign in the stars. Or I'm going to hear his voice in the wind. Do you know what I heard? I heard coyotes. Howling. Have you ever heard that? Have you ever heard that when you know that the night that's going to follow that sound is you alone in the wilderness? I gazed up at the stars. I thought, God, speak to me. I'm searching for you. And I fell asleep. What happened next? It hadn't happened to me before in my life, and it hasn't happened since. But I woke up for this reason. I was freezing. Have you ever been woken up because you're cold? I hadn't. It was mid-September, all the way up there in Maine, and I had a jacket on. I was freezing. And I looked over and the fire had died. There were some coals there still. And I was shaking. And I looked at the sky and it was all dark. The stars were there still. But I thought, I might die tonight. And I was serious. I was so cold, I thought, this is a threat to me. My only hope is, when the sun comes up in what, an hour or so, I'll be totally fine. And so with my shaking arms, I pulled my sleeve up to find my wristwatch, which told me that it was 9:30 p.m. Now, I thought of those women who asked me for my number and what they were implying, and I thought, maybe this is the answer that God has given. I remembered that verse that I memorized, ask and you will receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open. I thought to myself that night, I've knocked on the door of heaven, God has opened it and told me my plan for you is to die on Comedic Peak, September 14th. Does anyone else in here know what it's like to search for God, really to search for Him? Not to just say one afternoon, gosh, I really wish, you know, God would show himself to me and then forget about it another half an hour later. But really, in earnest, to set aside some time in your life to say, I need to know, is there a God? I want to find him. What does he want from me? What does he want for me? Who is he? Is he really there? Not just say it, but actually search for it. Does anybody in here know what that's like? And some of you have embarked on that search, have found him and then lost him again, or found yourselves lost again, and so you've searched again. But if you don't know what that's like, you must put yourself in the position of a person like that to see the Christmas story through the eyes of the Magi, through the wise men. Flip back a few pages from where you are in Matthew 7. And look at the first page of the book of Matthew. It's Matthew chapter 2 is where we see these seekers on page 783. In chapter 2 of Matthew, the news has been sent out there that something good has happened in this baby. And we meet in this chapter 2, King Herod, who we spoke about last week. And then we also meet some others called wise men. I want to read this with you, and I want you to look at it and try to see this story through the eyes of these wise men who are seekers. Look at what it says here in chapter 2. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage. When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, and you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people, Israel. I want to stop there, and I want you to turn the page back, and I want to make some observations with you. Let me tell you, what I mean to do tonight in looking at the story from their perspective is simple. I want us to see some significant and meaningful lessons about what it means to truly search for God. And then, from what happens in their story, I want us to see what happens when we do actually receive what we ask for when we see, and find what we're searching for when we look for God, when we come to Him. Now, in this first section I've read, these men come from the east with a question, where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? It's interesting that this is their question. We'll get to that in a moment. But the people they ask, Herod, the scribes, and the Pharisees, they have an answer for where he is to be born. Would someone who feels like getting some extra credit tonight shout out the answer? Where is he to be born? So I heard somebody say, Jerusalem, I can't believe it. It's Bethlehem. You have to leave. I'm kidding. He's to be born in Bethlehem. Let me ask you this. How do they know he was to be born in Bethlehem? How do they know? Look at it. I want you to see this. It's very simple. The prophets told them. Now, maybe you don't know this, or maybe you do. The prophets were the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament. For them, it was their scriptures. In this story, we meet a group of people, Herod, the scribes and the Pharisees, who have something. They have the scriptures, and the scriptures tell them where this Messiah is to be born, where God is going to come into the world in a unique way to do the thing that everybody needs him to do for them. They have the Bible that tells them this, but what don't they have? Now, this is easy to miss, but apparently they don't have eyes to see the signs of nature. Because when we read the Christmas story, the ones who see the signs of what God is up to are not the ones who have the scriptures. Now, there's a lesson there. The ones who see the signs of what God is up to are not the scribes and the Pharisees and the ones who have the words that God had passed on through the prophets. But instead, it's these folks we meet called wise men who see what God is doing. Who are the wise men? This is a question that's tricky to answer exactly historically, not because we don't have enough information about who these guys are, but because historically we have an enormous abundance of material about who these wise men are. Now, the word that is translated in our Bibles into wise men in the original text is not wise men. The word is magi. Have you heard this word magi? Most people have heard it because they're such popular characters. Does this word sound like it is connected to another word in our English language? Could you go ahead and show it? It's a lot easier to see than to hear. This is the word magi. It's connected to our word magic. Did it seem like I have a little magical powers just then? Yes. Magi. Centuries before this story, in ancient Persia, there was a caste of sorcerers or wizards or shaman or Zoroastrian priests or who knows what, but these men who were like magicians. And they had, it seemed to folks, they had strange powers to see the signs of nature or to interpret dreams or to gather wisdom from whatever sorcery or whatever hocus pocus they did. And so they grew a reputation for being men who were extraordinarily wise, but in particular were extraordinarily open to the signs of nature. And when we meet these wise men, these magi in Matthew, we're not told much about them except for two things that are important. First, we're told that they come from the east. And in relation to Jerusalem and where the story was told, that would have been Arabia or out in Mesopotamia. These men came from far away, and there's something else that we're told about them, and it is that they saw something happen in the heavens. They saw a star rising. And we can infer from what they've come to say to Herod this, and this is what you must all hear. Listen. These wise men from far away were looking into the heavens in hopes of seeing something. For some reason, they had it in their minds that if they kept their eyes open and observed what was happening in the world around them, that somehow they might see something that told them about God, whoever that God was. Whether they knew much about him or not, they were gazing toward the stars in hopes of seeing some sign that he was still involved in the world. This is who these men were. They were men who were, in the terms that Jesus put in Matthew 7, who were seeking, who were asking, and who were knocking. And what had happened is they saw something that spoke to them unmistakably of the involvement of God in the world. And through a very small, little tiny group of people, the Jews, who were far away from Mesopotamia, they believed that God was telling them he was going to come and do something in this baby that was going to have significance for the entire world. And so what they did is they got up from where they were, far away in the east, and they made the long journey from Mesopotamia all the way to the city of Jerusalem. And they asked, "Where is the one who has been born king?" Listen, if you will keep your eyes open truly and look for God, he will reveal himself. This is a promise that comes from Jesus. We see this already in this story, in what happens with these wise men from far away who were searching and asking and knocking. They saw what God was doing, and so they came. Now, let me ask this. Anyone here study science? Did anybody? A few of you? Some of you are wondering, what was this star that they saw? Anyone wondering about that? Have you ever wondered about that? Is it really a star? Some people have asked this question and just said, listen, this is just a story, and it's the literary device that this author uses to make this seem heavenly and important, and also to make nice Christmas cards. And that's it. And in fact, that's what some people have said. I personally don't believe that, and I'll tell you why. I am convinced that it is true that when people seek after God, they find him. Even if they end up sleeping on the top of a mountain for a night, where they freeze almost to death, God makes himself known, not just inside of our hearts in a nice warm feeling, but in reality and in history. There are theories about what this star was. Three of them have been popular. One, maybe you've heard this theory, is it wasn't a new star, it was an old star that died, a supernova. Do you know about a supernova? You know what those are? A supernova is something that actually happens when a star explodes, and it can be very bright. And in fact, dozens of these happen every year. Usually they're not that visible, but occasionally they can be so bright that even in the daytime they can be seen. They can be as bright as the moon. And this happens maybe once a century. So some have speculated perhaps the star that these men saw was that, just a supernova. The problem with that theory is it's impossible to defend. Another theory has been, it's a comet. Anyone here see with their own eyes Halley's Comet? There are some who have advanced the theory. That was in 1984, right? Is that right? Does anybody remember? 89? How often does it come around? Someone who's a scientist, tell us. 77 years, I saw it. You said that, right? 75? I think it's 77. Maybe 75. Theory was advanced that's
we'll
what it was.
We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. We might, if someone advanced that theory that it was Halley's Comet, the problem is if you count backward, it doesn't match up with Jesus' birth. There's one other theory that's been put forth, and this one, I think, is the one that is right. Has anyone here ever heard of Johannes Kepler? Yeah? How many laws of motion did he have? I can't believe this. Three. Someone said three. Kepler's three laws. It's always three in church. Like 3 points in the sermon, Trinity. Oh. Jupiter and Saturn are the two planets that are most visible with the naked eye. We can see them in the night sky. And they have the slowest period around the sun. They're the planets that have the slowest period around the sun that we can see. One of them, it takes 13 years to go around the sun. The other takes 30 years. And because of this, every 20 years, these two planets overlap in our line of sight. This is at the point when they're in conjunction. Have you ever heard that term, planetary conjunction? Every 20 years, in the night sky, Jupiter and Saturn will look to us as if they're aligned, and when that happens, it appears as though there is a star there that's brighter than any other star we've seen. I'm not sure when this happened last, but when it happens, it's extremely, apparently, very visibly striking, because here you have two planets that are on top of one another, and they're closer than all the stars are, so they look like a gigantic star that wasn't there before. Now, there's a more rare occurrence that happens less frequently than 20 years, and it is when a third planet, Mars, which is also visible with our eyes from Earth, overlaps those two. So that not only are Jupiter and Saturn aligned, but a third planet, Mars, is also looks to us to be right in line with them. And so you have three planets coming together. You know when this happened last? In 1604, October. And Johannes Kepler saw it with his own eyes. Just last month, how many years ago is that? Anybody a whiz at math? 404, is that right? He saw with his own eyes these three planets come together. And he began to speculate, why, how did this happen, and so on. And he began to realize that planets moved in this elliptical orbit, and he calculated how frequently will it happen that these three come together. Because when those three came together, it was the brightest thing in the night sky next to the moon that he'd ever seen. You know how often this happens? Once every 805 years. That means that prior to the time that Kepler first saw it happen in the year 799. It means that it won't happen again until 2409, I think, or something like that. So none of us will see it. We'll all be dead before that happens again. But it will happen that all three of these come together. And when it does, it will be so bright, it will look like nothing any of us have ever seen. Now, real quick, a little more math. Herod, the king, who was around when this happened. Does anybody know when he died? It was in National Geographic, the one that was just published. Did anybody see that? Nobody did? He was born in 73. He died in the year 4 B.C. You know what B.C. stands for? Before Christ. Wait, he died before Christ? Someone asked me this. Oh my gosh, is National Geographic right? Is this all fake? He died B.C.? This is something that most people don't know about, but the dating of Christ's birth was mistaken at the time that the Romans shifted the calendar to be around his birth, and they got it wrong. So he wasn't born on 0 B.C. Christ was born around 6 B.C. And then 2 years after that is when Herod wanted him dead. Remember this? We talked about this last week. He killed all the babies who were under 2, and then shortly after that he died, and then Jesus was allowed to come back from Egypt. So that means Jesus was born in 6 B.C. I want someone in here to subtract 805 from 1604 twice. You know what year that is? 6 B.C. Now listen, you can find in Persian records, the astronomers in Persia were all over this stuff. They were. You can find records of their astronomy, and they talk about this happening. In December of 07 B.C., Jupiter and Mars were together, and then the following year, for 3 months, Mars was also overlapping. And so that means that the stars were aligned. The planets came together and produced some bright speck that was outstanding for these men who were looking into the heavens and asking God, are you there? Are you real? Is there some plan that you have? Our wisdom tells us that there is a God out there who is going to come into this world and rescue us from this mess. Now let me ask you this. All of you who are seekers, don't you see that this world is messed up? Don't you see that even though it's messed up, there is something in it that you can't deny? Love. You've seen it before. You've felt it rising yourself. You've seen it in other people. There's no explanation for that other than that there is a God who somehow is holding this thing, and he is good. And if you would seek for him, as these men did, they saw in the heavens this sign, and it led them to Bethlehem. And there they asked, where is this king, who's not only king over you and your small people, but over this whole world? And this is the first lesson about seeking that we get from these men. It is very simple. If you will keep your eyes open and look for him, then he will reveal himself to you if you will really look. And that goes for those of us who are Christians and have been looking to him for a while, and those of us who haven't yet been Christians and we're just now starting on the search. You should seek him. Now listen, I just realized it's like 5 and 6, and I have a lot more to say. Should I stop?
No.
Okay, good. Let me go quickly then. Okay, you're saying, well, you started your sermon by telling us about the story of you seeking God, but you thought that you were going to die. Now, you can tell that I didn't die that night on the mountain, right? You know, it's got a happy ending. I didn't die. Well, this is what I did. I started the fire up again, and I put some stones in the fire and got as close as I could. And then I fell asleep, and I woke up half an hour later when it died, and I did it again. And I did that all night. I started taking rocks out of the fire and putting them down my pants and in my shirt. And I made it. And I prayed all night, God, would you please tell me, what do you want me to do with this life that you've given me? It can't be what I thought it was. Do you have a plan for me? What is this world for me? What do you have for me? What am I supposed to do? Where are you leading me? I had a dream. And in this dream, there was a faculty member from Princeton, where I was a student, who wasn't in the department that I was studying in. It was a woman, and she came to me in my dream, and this is what she said. Christian, let me teach you. That's what she said. I woke up after that dream, and now for the first time of that horrible night, the sky was beginning to betray that the sun was coming up. And so I gathered myself up and my axe and the remaining jerky, and I started heading down the mountain. And in my mind, I was playing it over and over again. Why did I see her asking me to let her teach me? I got down to my car, I started it up, I turned on the heat, and I began to drive. 2 hours later, I turned on my cell phone. I was coming around through Massachusetts at this point. My phone rang. Now, I don't have a lot of stories like these, but this is one of those stories. It was this professor calling me on the phone. I saw 609. That was the area code for Princeton, a number I didn't recognize. I picked up the phone. Hello? She said, Christian, it's... And she didn't need to say it. I knew already it was her. She'd never called me before. I said, what is it? She asked me this question. She said, I know the semester starts in like 2 days. I'm in a bind. The teaching fellow that I had to work with me quit. And I thought of you. Would you be willing to fill in and work with me? I laughed. She said, why are you laughing? Does this mean no? I said, no. I said, I had a dream last night. You appeared to me and asked me if I would let you teach me. She was sort of silent. Now, she might have felt that was profound, or she might have wanted to reconsider her request. I don't know. Do you know what happened in that semester? This was in September, the mid-September. In that semester, through working with this woman, I heard without any question God saying to me, Christian, you are not to continue studying preaching. This woman worked in the pastoral care and counseling department. Through the experiences I was having in that class, God was saying to me, through her, this woman, and through what was happening there, you are not to go on this academic path towards stuffiness and trying to teach people to preach. You don't know what you're talking about preaching. How could you teach anyone? God was saying, you need to go in a different direction. Listen to me. Do you know what happened? This is September 15th, I begin there working with her. Just 4 months later, less than 4 months later, I've told this story before. In January of the next year, January 9th, not even 4 months has passed, and I'm getting a phone call from the ragtag group of people that started this church that we're in tonight. One of the guy who called me is right there. And he says to me, I want you to come out here because we think God is calling this group to do something that we think God wants you to be a part of. If you ask, you will receive. If you seek, you will find. If you knock, the door will be open. It may not be what you expect. Now, listen, I go through all this to say, you trust me here. My experience tells me this, and I trust the word of God here and the experience of others, that if you seek, you will find. But there's one other, there's a very subtle lesson here that you must hear. Did I hear God alone on the mountain? No. I didn't hear him by myself. And this is my question for you. From this Christmas story, how many magi were there? Someone tell me, how many wise men are there? Three. Maybe. Maybe not. You know, if you look through there if you want, it doesn't say how many there are. It says there are three gifts. It just says there are magi. Now, the word magi is the plural of an old... sorry. I'm trying to get it out of my memory. It's not Persian. Anybody know what word is? Magus. Have you ever heard that word, magus? It's not Vegas. Rhymes with Vegas. Starts with an M. Magus is a single form of magi. We don't meet any magus here. We meet magi. If you look at the ancient art of the catacombs of the 3rd and 2nd and 4th centuries and so on, you'll see sometimes there's two, sometimes there's four. In ancient, in the Eastern scrolls, there's 12 magi, and they all have names. But we settle on three. The point isn't how many there are. The point is that there's more than one. And this is an extraordinarily important point. You must hear this. You can't make the journey from the east toward Jesus by yourself. It's not just that it's not convenient, and it isn't convenient. If you try to make it by yourself, it will be hard, and you won't be, you'll get lost, and you'll be lonely, and that will be very difficult. But you might think, is he just saying for convenience sake, I should try to take one or more travelers with me? No, I don't think it's possible to hear and know God by yourself. And this story shows us that when seeking, it's best done with a group. Now, this group here, this whole group, everyone in here, including the people who don't believe and the people who are quite strong in their faith, in one way, we are all together. We ought to be all together searching for God. And those of us who are strong and secure should bring along those who aren't so much so. And those of us who are not secure should ask questions of those who have seemingly more wisdom or more ideas. But never, ever should we try to go at knowing God alone. And that is the second lesson that comes very clearly through this story, that we must know that searching for God is done in groups. This is practical. I just want to say this as an aside. Maybe by a show of hands, how many people who are here tonight are in a small group? A lot of us are. Some of you might not. What is a small group? What does that mean? In this church, one of the things that we've done is we've seen this need to search for God together is that we've taken time to meet weekly or every other week with people that are traveling with us. I have a group of five guys that meets at my house Thursday, 6:15 in the morning, and we get together, we talk about what's going on in our lives, and we pray for each other every week. I could not journey toward the Savior without them. It's not possible. You cannot travel alone. Maybe a small group doesn't work for you, but you must find a way to gather with others traveling toward Jesus. All right, that's my second point. I have another one, and that's it. Is that all right? One more. This one's got some slides. All right. I talked about the Magi. Let's see. All right? Let's take a look at these Magi. Let's see. All right. Yeah, you said there weren't three, but most art has three because that's what everybody likes. All right? At some point early on, we get this thing about their names. Can anyone read that? Balthazar, great restaurant. It's a restaurant in the city, but that's supposed to be Balthazar. This is Melchior, and this is Gaspar. Go ahead. Later on, as the tradition develops, and you can't see this at all, but you got to trust me, these three wise men begin to represent different races. This one up here is Balthazar. He's black-skinned. He's supposed to have a beard. This one here is Melchior. He's ruddy in complexion. Okay? And then this is the white guy here with the beard. All right? Keep going. Let's see some more. Here's an easier picture to see. Artists begin to represent these guys. I know, he doesn't look like he's doing so well. These three begin to represent all people traveling toward Jesus. Early on, the church recognizes that there's some symbolic function in this, in what's going on here, in these wise men. And it continues. Go ahead. Even into the modern day. I think this might be either an old film or a Saturday Night Live skit. Again, we see the different races representing all people. And then even on into our own day, artists continue. Now, okay, some of you can't see this all that well, but this is like the whole manger scene. We've got Joseph here, Mary, and then the angel and the baby Jesus, and then here's Balthazar, Melchior, and go ahead, let's see a close-up. Okay, if you don't know this, this is a woman who's in our church. That's a false mustache. So is that, and that's a beard. Okay. This is our Christmas card, and I cleared it with her if I could use this. She said that if God could use her card to instruct people, that'd be great. Now, leave that up for just a minute. Turn the page and go back to verse 7 in Matthew 2, chapter 7. This is another very simple point about what it means to really seek after God. Verse 7 tells us that after Herod hears this news, that these guys who have open eyes to see what God is doing in the world, these seekers, have come far away, and they're the ones who've seen what God is up to. After he learns this, he gets very afraid, and so he comes up with a plan, and verse 7 tells us what he does. Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." Now that's a lie. We talked about this last week. Herod wants to know when the baby was born so he can eradicate this threat to his being the king. And it doesn't work, as we talked about this last week. That's one response. How does Herod strike you? Does he strike you as a happy person? No, he's miserable. He's gloomy and sad. And you know why? It's because he thinks he's in charge of everything. And he wants to be God. And the world is full of people like that. And those people are miserable. And they may appear to be happy for a while. The one who lives for himself or herself. The one who acts as if they're the king or queen of everything. They may seem to be successful and glad. But in the end, every time you see someone like that, their heart is empty and hollow and cold. They're lost. They know that they've not found what they're looking for. They are afraid and in the dark. And Herod is too. And he's a miserable man. And that's what it's like when a person gives up on the search for God and turns away and follows themselves as if they were God. But look at the contrast in verse 9. When they had heard the king, this is the wise men, these magi, they set out. And there ahead of them went the star that they had seen in its rising until it stopped over the place where the child was. Here's what I want you to see in verse 10. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. Now, this phrase, overwhelmed with joy, this is the translator's way of rendering an awkward Greek phrase, which basically says, rejoicing exceedingly with great joy. it's awkward because it's like, how many times do you need to say joy? Rejoicing. Joy. Well, okay, they were rejoicing with joy. It was exceeding joy. It was exceedingly great joy. Why would the author have to say so much about what this is like? Rejoicing exceedingly with great joy. Are there any parents in here who remember what it was like when they saw their child born? You better not remember that. You're too young, kid. Some kid in the back saying that. It was a Sunday night, 4:45. Michelle and I were at Riverview Hospital. Matt Agresti was up here preaching. Less than 10 months ago. I was holding Michelle's hand and she was scared. We were excited. The doctor said, "Here he is." And held Nathaniel up over that screen. He looked like a purple monster. And he started to scream. Like that. And Michelle and I, listen to what we did. We both started to cry and laugh at the same time. And just held each other and laughed and cried. We were so glad. I took Nathaniel into my hands and brought him right next to Michelle's face. And we were flooded with we were overwhelmed. We were rejoicing greatly with exceeding joy. Some of you know what that's like from experience. You remember that? Listen to me. Searching truly. Not just saying, "I'm going to look for God." Really searching for Him. Keeping your eyes open to what God is doing in the world, and then bringing that knowledge of what you see Him doing in the world together, even with the church that's got it all screwed up like Herod's church did, and asking, "Well, I've seen God. What do the scriptures have to say about where He is?" And then listening to what they say, like these wise men did, because they heard where Jesus was from these crooked church people. And when they heard that and they went, the experience resulted in overwhelming joy. And if you want to know what the search is to be like that leads to this king, you must know that it is a search that ends in overwhelming joy. And some of you know what that's like, don't you? And if you don't, you might just be on the mountain waking up and it's 9:30. And you might think that the fire's out and you're dead. But the coals were burning still, and I could throw some wood on there, and the wind whipped up. And it started again, and I made it through that night. And if you will seek, you will find. If you ask, not for whatever you want, but if you ask God to help you see what He wants and ask for it, and if you knock to see the doors that He will open, He will be found. You will find Him. He will open the door for you, and you will be able to go in the right way. When you do, what will you find? This is what I'm going to close with. Look at this. Verse 11 says, "On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they knelt down and they paid him homage." That word that's translated homage is a technical term for they basically lie down on the ground face first to worship Him. And the reason, look what it says, "They opened their treasure chests, they offered Him gifts." We just sang in that bleak midwinter song, "What can I give Him as poor as I am? What I give to Him is my heart." When you find Him, you might think, when I find God, finally He's going to give me all the things I want. But you notice, they don't come to this child and say, "What can you give me?" They give Him gifts, and look at the gifts. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Okay, let's check this out real quick. I think this is gold. This is frankincense, and this is myrrh. Is Nora here? That kind of took a little bit of the wind out of my sails, so I'm not going to stop. Already in the second century, before the year 200, there were people, men and women, talking about what these gifts symbolized. And there was a sermon by a guy named Irenaeus before the year 200 that started to circulate. It was his defense against these heretics. He wrote this thing that started to circulate, in which he talked about what these gifts mean. And do you know, and he said this, and I think he's right. They tell us something about the identity of the one that we find when we come to Jesus. You know what gold symbolizes? It's one of the most abundantly used symbols in the scriptures. Always for something precious. Something that it doesn't tarnish. It's long-lasting. It's highly valuable. Gold was the thing that king's crowns are made out of. And so in this first gift we see here that when you ask after God, what you will come to is you will come to the king. You don't come to God as your buddy or your pal, first of all. Your co-pilot. God save us from those bumper stickers. Here in the manger, if someone has that bumper sticker, I'm sorry. Here in the manger, we find that when we come to God, we come to the King. That's the first thing. This second one here, this is frankincense. Frankincense was the fragrance. It's a fragrance. I actually have some. Someone gave me some of this. It's a fragrance that was used in some very, very important incense. If you know the book of Exodus, you know that there was a time when God met with Moses and he gave him a recipe. He gave him a recipe for a sacred incense that should be burned at one time. When the high priest came into the Holy of Holies, the temple, when the high priest came into that very holy space, he was to burn this stuff. It smells good. It's just a resin from a tree that's in the Middle East. He was to burn this, and that odor would signal to everyone who was around who couldn't go into the Holy of Holies. It was to signal that there was something special going on, that God himself had come to be with the people in the Holy of Holies. And so this fragrance, this frankincense, which was brought right into there, it smelled like God was near. And this second gift tells us that not only when we come to this baby do we see the King, but we see God. Now, I want those of us who would seek after who God is, we might have our ideas that he's strong or mighty or frightening or scary, and in some ways perhaps he is, but he is also the one who has come in a baby to make himself so vulnerable. Why would he do this? He would do this to be with us so that he knows everything about what it's like to be a person. This one who you may be seeking knows what it's like to be an infant from the inside, because he's done it. God with us is there at the manger. And so if you would seek after God, you would find not only the King, but the one who is God himself right there. Does that astound you? I told this story the first year that we had OR with high school students. And there was this girl there who'd never heard the Christmas story perhaps. And she looked at me and said, "This is so weird." I said, "Why?" She said, "God, a baby? That's absurd. How could he be so weak? You would think that God would come in with muscles and power and swinging a mighty sword. Is this what you Christians believe?" And the answer is yes. Now, there's something in that that should cause our hearts to leap, to know that God would think so much of us. Now, there's one other gift, and I want to end with this one. And this is myrrh. Myrrh was, as you may know, an incense that was used for embalming. When a person died, the spice that was used to preserve their body was myrrh. And this is brought because this King, who is God, and he is the King, and he is God, is going to die. Again, this should shatter our thoughts about who we think God is supposed to be. Isn't God supposed to be mighty and invulnerable? Already at his birth, this baby is destined for a throne that is a cross. And there's a reason. And the reason is that he has come to give his life as a ransom for those who would seek him. He has come to set the captives free by becoming a captive. He has come as the Son of God into the far country to be lost and to be ruined for those who are lost and ruined, to rescue them from their misery. He has come as the Holy One to become the criminal on the cross, to set those criminals free. He has come to open blind eyes, to find those sheep that are lost and recover them, by becoming himself the sheep who is lost to God. And this, in the Christmas story, is the vision of why every one of us who seeks, if we would find him, have reason to rejoice with overwhelming joy. Because the King, who is God, loves us so that he has come to seek after those who would seek him, to find them, to rescue them from death and the misery of this world. Now, I want you to listen, every one of you, all of us are on a search. All of us are on a search for God. We are seekers who are meant to keep our eyes open, to travel with others, and to be aware of what we will find if we find this God, the King who is God with us, who is a sufferer. And this is a message of great joy. Let's pray that God will make it so for us.